Most of us are familiar with the smiling face of the African-American lady on the box of pancake mix and the bottle of syrup. It should be no surprise that Aunt Jemima is a fictional character.
Now, I hate to disappoint you, but I ain't your Aunt Jemima. And I ain't your mammy, and I ain't your aunt. My name Nancy. Nancy Green.
What does the use of Aunt Jemima for marketing pancake products say about racial stereotyping in America? The Kentucky Humanities Council is hosting a community conversation about the topic, Aunt Jemima and the Complexities of Race. On this week's Eastern Standard, that's our topic, and we're glad to hear from you. Send us an email now, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Send a tweet at WEKUEST. Post on the Facebook page or the website. In just a little while, we'll open the phones as well. It's time for Eastern Standard and our discussion of racial stereotypes right after the news from NPR. From the studios of WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, this is Eastern Standard. Hello, I am John Hingsbergen. This week, another interesting conversation with the rise of white supremacy movements. The issue of racism has been a conversation that is being discussed in many places in our nation and, of course, here in Kentucky. Kentucky Humanities has created an event to foster an open discussion on race relations in Central Kentucky titled Aunt Jemima and the Complexities of Race. The event is this evening, this Thursday, when the program is live here on Thursday morning. And Aunt Jemima herself will be there. We'll hear more about actress performing, playing the part of Aunt Jemima, as well as other voices discussing this topic of racism and the complexities of race, racial stereotyping. We have with us a number of people in the studio this morning, and we have a guest on Skype as well, and we'll get to her in just a moment. But first, let me introduce Bill Goodman, Executive Director of the Kentucky Humanities Council. Bill worked for KET for a number of years, from 1996, most known for being the host of Kentucky Tonight. And Bill has also released a collection of personal essays, Beans, Biscuits, Family, and Friends Life Stories. Bill Goodman, thank you so much for being with us.
John, thanks for having us today.
Always glad to have you here in the studio, Bill. And I don't know why I'm not hearing you. Let me try that microphone again. Let's talk again.
John, thanks for having us on the program. We appreciate it.
Okay, that's much, much better. Thank you, Bill Goodman. Also with us, we have us Judge John Schrader, practicing attorney, former family court judge. John Schrader was Fayette family court judge for 8 years, now a practicing attorney with Shero Schrader and Sutherland Law Firm. He is trained as a family court mediator and focuses on helping families resolve disputes in a peaceful manner. John Schrader, thank you so much for being here.
It's my pleasure.
Also with us, we have with us Ricardo Nazario Colon. And I am trying to find your materials here, Mr. Colon. I apologize. I'm a little bit disorganized on this Thursday morning, up early this morning. Ah, great. Thank you so much. And he is Chief Diversity Officer at the Western Carolina University. I know you've also been on faculty of a number of campuses here in Kentucky over the years. Thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We hope to get an interesting conversation rolling here, and including our guest who is on Skype this morning. And this is Dr. Kelly Madison. And Kelly Madison is professor of cultural politics and media studies at California State University in Los Angeles. And I know you're in Lexington for the workshop this evening, but joining us by Skype this morning. Kelly Madison, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
The Skype connection is going to be a little bit rough, so hopefully we'll be able to hear you okay. We'll verify that it's working all right. But if we need to, we might have to switch to the telephone for a better sounding connection. Let's get started with this conversation. First of all, let me invite our listeners to be part of the conversation. This is an interactive show. We encourage you to write to us at any time with a question, a comment, a personal story. Write to us by email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com, or send a tweet at wekuest. And just a little while, we'll open the phone lines for you to be part of the conversation. But let's start with Bill Goodman of the Kentucky Humanities Council. And Bill, tell us all about this workshop and its origins and how this came about.
John, thanks again. We live in interesting times. That goes without saying. We find ourselves in a place where there are a lot of questions all over the nation, emanating from not only Washington, D.C., but all the way down to Kentucky and to local cities and governments who are having discussions about everything from monuments to school education to many other topics involving all of us. At Kentucky Humanities, we think one of our goals is to be an agency statewide that can bring people together to not take a position, but to bring people together to discuss some of the tough, complex issues of the day. And that's what we're going to be doing tonight when we present Aunt Jemima and the Complexities of Race. John, this actually began more than a year ago, before Charlottesville, before some of the arguments about monuments and statues all over the nation and in Kentucky. This was a program that we wanted to have. Aunt Jemima is one of our new Chautauqua actors who will begin performing this fall. Nancy Green is her real name. She was born and raised in Montgomery County in Mount Sterling, Kentucky, many, many years ago. And she was asked by a Mr. Davis at that time to begin to perform as Aunt Jemima. She was the very first and original Aunt Jemima of pancake fame. She performed, made her debut at the World's Fair in 1909, and then, frankly, she went on to become quite well-known as Aunt Jemima, but then as an African-American woman of some prominence in Chicago. She ended her life by doing good deeds of serving many people through her role and some wealth that she accumulated. But she was a stereotype at the time. She was the stereotype of a black house servant, if you will. And she was funny. She talked a lot. Mr. Davis eventually then sold the company, as I understand it, to the Quaker Oats people who still have pancakes today. So we're using Aunt Jemima as our character to kick off this conversation tonight. With this very esteemed panel of whom everyone is going to be represented here on the radio today except Gerald Smith, who's a professor of African-American history at the University of Kentucky. He will join our panel, and the discussion will be moderated by KET's Renee Shaw. And we really want the audience free and open to the public tonight at the Lyric Theater starting at 6:30, and the panel to engage in a conversation about the complexities of race and race relations that we find in our nation today.
And, of course, our program repeats on the Sunday evening, and listeners can hear it on podcast. So we're going to try to make this conversation such that it has value for you after the fact of this Thursday evening session. Let me ask our guests in some degree of order here to weigh in on this topic, why this is important to you. And let me start with Dr. Kelly Madison, who is joining us by Skype. She'll be part of the panel this evening. Again, she's a professor of cultural politics and media studies at California State University in Los Angeles. Why is this topic important to you, Kelly Madison?
Well, I think that it's hard for people to understand the complexities of race and race relations because they're even more complex than we think, because in reality, we don't have any race relations. We have racism relations. Scientists have thrown out the concept of race as a valid biological category. The idea of race was created from the very beginning as a divide and conquer strategy, and it's amazing that it still functions like that today. But from the very beginning, when the first Africans came to what is now known as the United States, there were no white people here, as Theodore Allen pointed out, because the concept of whiteness didn't exist. That concept, which was arising with European colonialism to rationalize the violence, the theft, the exploitation of that growing mode of colonialism, the concept of race was created because people were rising up united in what became the United States, against the plantation elite, against the system of indentured servitude, and they created and used this newly arising idea of race and put it into laws in the later 1600s, in order to stop those rebellions by making it so that people could not unite and join together across so-called racial lines.
Let me check in. Yes, sure.
So that's a complexity beyond the complexities that we are also dealing with today with the resurgence of white supremacy, the ways in which race makes it so that it's impossible for us to have things, for example, like the last show was talking about, universal health care, because we're pitted against each other with ideas of some people not wanting other people to have something because they think that means that they'll have less. And a lot of it is rooted in the racialization that occurred in this country.
Ricardo Nazario Colon, Chief Diversity Officer for Western Carolina University, working with students and staff to encourage and discuss diversity on that campus. I guess most every campus has somebody in a position similar to yours. Talk about, again, why this issue is important to you.
For me, as someone of Latino Hispanic background, that we're considered new arrivals to this country, but the Latino Hispanic population has been around in this continent, in this part of the world, since the same period of time as the colonial Anglo folks that came here. And we had those debates over centuries. You know, in Kentucky, the Hispanic Latino population heritage goes back as early as World War I with soldiers arriving at Fort Knox, and then in the horse industry, jockeys. And since then, while we have not had a public presence in numbers, there have been folks here for over 100 years in this state, in this region. And it is important because the Hispanic population, the Latino population is in arguably, and I believe this, a multiracial population, and with anything it can be debated either way, but I believe we are a multiracial population, and we're pitted against each other, and we're given messages through the media as to what is the best way to navigate the spaces in the United States. So there is this ideology in the media that says, if you identify as a person that's of white ancestry, then there are benefits associated with that identity. It is interesting in that when Puerto Rico had its first U.S. census, 80% of the population identified as white. And we know that that is not true. But there was this ideology that if you identify as white, there might be some type of inherent benefit. We don't know what it is, but just in case, go ahead and check that box. And in college campuses, we're now a microcosm, or we are a microcosm of the larger society. People come.
We're going to take a short break, and we will certainly get to Judge John Schrader in just a few moments. Our guests are here to discuss issues of racial stereotyping in the context of this workshop that's being offered by Kentucky Humanities, Aunt Jemima and the Complexities of Race on this week's Eastern Standard. Feel free to be part of our conversation at 800-621-8890. Send us an email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Send a tweet at wekuest. We'll take a short break and be right back.
They had set about looking for somebody that reminded them of their mammy and their whatnot. Said she need be a good cook, need be funny, need like talk. Well, I's a good cook, and I's funny. Well, I think so anyway. And Lord knows I love to talk. Well, they hired me to sell their pancakes, and that's what I gone and done.
And this is an actress portraying the role of Nancy Green, who portrayed Aunt Jemima for a good number of years. Bill Goodman of Kentucky Humanities. Tell us a little bit more of this actress. Her name is Judy Falk?
No, Deborah.
Deborah Falk, I'm sorry.
Deborah Falk, John. She is a Lexington native, but spent a lot of her training in schooling and in the theater in California. She's returned to Central Kentucky, developed this character along with some of our dramatists and professionals that help our Chautauqua actors develop their characters. And I've seen the performance. She's going to perform just a brief segment of a longer presentation that she's doing all over the state of Kentucky starting this fall. Quite honestly, it is just extraordinary. She really brings this character to life, and she takes the character from the Aunt Jemima stereotype as the pancake maker all the way up to a very prominent and successful business woman in Chicago in her later years. There's a lot of lesson and education in her performance. It's quite an extraordinary performance.
So Aunt Jemima will be as part of the workshop at the Lyric Theater Arts and Cultural Center in Lexington on this Thursday evening. And kicking off this conversation, Renee Shaw of KET, your former colleague Bill Goodman, moderating this discussion.
And my colleague and good friend Renee Shaw will be moderating the panel discussion. We will begin at 6:30 at the Lyric with this community conversation, and one that we hope the community will not only enjoy the performance, be challenged by what the panel has to say, but then also participate with Q&A with the panel during this event tonight.
To what extent was this a session set up as a reaction to what is going on? We've had racial tensions with shootings by police officers. We've had some uprisings in some communities, people getting upset about the way minorities are treated in some communities. We've had this issue of white supremacists feeling somewhat empowered, apparently, in the past year since the election of the current president. Is that the context in which this was launched, or was this something planned long before any of these events?
This community conversation has been in a planning stage for a year, John. So pegging it to one particular incident would not be proper. But as Dr. Madison just pointed out, we've been dealing with these complex issues in the United States for hundreds of years. And maybe some of us are just beginning to understand how complex they really are. And what all of us need to understand and know about our fellow brother and sister and the struggles and the strife that they have lived through their entire life, going back to generations, their fathers, their grandmothers. And that's the reason that long before Charlottesville, we decided that this was an important topic that we needed to bring to Kentucky.
Let's turn to Judge John Schrader, former judge, a former family court judge in Fayette County, practicing attorney. And John, why is this of interest to you? And is this related to your role as a family court judge and some of the issues that you dealt with in that position?
Well, John, on your first question, I'm interested in this because I have seven grandchildren. And I don't want to see them go through the things that I've gone through and the things that are happening today and in the last 10 days even are alarming to me. I'm very much concerned about the crisis that we're looking at, and I want to play a role in trying to do something about it. As far as my role as a judge, I certainly saw these issues and had to deal with them on a daily basis. I learned very quickly that I didn't care what color a person was, what color hair they might have, what tattoos they might have, as I looked across the table in the courtroom and tried to find the best parent to take care of an innocent child. And so, yes, that came into play, and my predispositions, if you will, were challenged immediately as I took that job on. But what I really think was important in terms of this issue for me was paternity court. I would call a docket of 75 cases once a week, and 65 of them would be African American. And I saw the hole that these gentlemen were digging for themselves that was just impossible to get out of. I've done the calculations on the cost of having a baby and going through paternity court, and they're staggering. And I've realized that we need to talk to our young people about having babies when they're not ready to take care of them, either practically or financially.
Pardon my lack of understanding here or my naivete, but I'm wondering, paternity issues and, of course, problems in the family structures in many, many communities, why is that related to racism? Why is that a problem that has roots beyond irresponsibility on the part of a given person?
Well, there's a lot that goes into that, of course. And I dealt with a committee as a judge that looked into the reasons that we have a higher proportion of African Americans in court for both paternity and neglect and abuse cases. And one thing I think that is very telling is that we are as a society labeling some of these young people based on diagnostic tests, psychological tests that were created by white people, white men, 100 years ago, some of them. And this is creating an uneven playing field, if you will, and challenging the minority children who are expected to understand and relate to the questions on these exams.
John, I would also like to ask Dr. Madison to respond to that, because her study and the work that she's done all of her life directly relates to not just what has happened in the young people that Judge Schrader has seen in his court in the last few years, but again, institutional racism that goes back many, many decades, generations, that has led some of these men to stand before the judge. So if Dr. Madison could weigh in on that, I would appreciate that.
Yes, thank you. Well, I know that those men aren't in court because of their race, because as I said before, race does not exist. They're in there because of the way that they've been racialized and the generational impact of that. Slavery, the enslavement of Africans, was nothing if not the complete and utter destruction of the black family. And it's interesting when you shift to an understanding that race isn't real, but racism is, and you understand the history of how people were racialized, not how their races, but how they were racialized, and the way that that was used to rationalize and normalize and biologize certain types of access to resources and whether or not you were allowed to be violated, then you'd understand why it is that there would be so many so-called black men in that position of not having the financial wherewithal to take care of children, of having issues of paternity and that, you know, we're focused on. We might want to focus historically in terms of understanding the context of that on issues of paternity and irresponsibility with regards to people who are enslaving other people, dividing up their families. We're going to be speaking at the Frederick Douglass School. If you read the first chapter of Frederick Douglass's autobiography, you'll learn some really horrendous things, unspeakable things that happened to Frederick Douglass in relation to his family and his ability to have a mother and a father and all of those things. So part of what I'm saying is that we've been conditioned to think about things in terms of race. But what we need to understand is the impact of racialization, which will answer all of these questions about how it is that we're divided based on the history of what was done socially, politically, and economically to people, not based on their skin color, because skin color has absolutely nothing to do with whether or not you're going to be a good father or have a particular family system, except in the context where your skin color was made to mean that you didn't have certain rights as a human being for centuries, much longer than we've had any type of freedom in the United States for people who were defined as non-white.
The session that the Kentucky Humanities is sponsoring is called the Complexities of Race. And I think, Dr. Kelly Madison, you're a good example of the study and the work that you have done to spell out the fact that this is not a very simple issue. It's not just as simple as you look different than I do, you come from a different background than I do, therefore I am prejudiced against you because of that. It's, as you say, far more complex, based in our history, based in the way certain people came to this country, and they were in servitude and slavery, and everything that followed as a result of that became factors that change the way things are today in our society, I guess. Would you say that's the root of it all, when it, especially we talked about the African Americans in our culture? So many of the issues, so many of the problems are the fact that the folks came here unwillingly as slaves.
Yes, and were treated as wealth as opposed to being allowed to accumulate wealth, and were treated as if they weren't human beings based on this rationalization, which is what racism is. It's a rationalization for treating other people in a way that is violent.
Because folks wanted to, they were trying to make a go of it. They were trying to make financial gain out of using other people. And so they had to rationalize, say, you're less than I, you're not a full human. As a result, I can justify using another person.
Yes. And in addition to that, the other great thing about race for people who had power and the plantation elite was that it was, it could be used to divide the indentured servants at first, because even Africans, when they first came to the United States, were not enslaved in a racialized system of slavery. They were also treated as indentured servants, but they were rising up against the plantation elite and asking for a more just society. And shortly thereafter, we start to see laws that start including the very first ideas of there being such a thing as a white person or a black person in our policy. And those laws were about making sure they don't get together, mm-hmm. and making one group into a group that you can enslave for life. And then allowing, as Martin Luther King actually put it, he talked about how the segregation and the creation of black and white people was about the Southern aristocracy taking the world and giving the poor white man Jim Crow. So when he's hungry, all he has is this psychological bird, Jim Crow, that lets him know that no matter how bad off he is, at least he's better than a black man. He said that the segregated, that the plantation elite, the powers that be in the United States, segregated Southern money from poor whites. And they segregated the Negro from everything, and that's what happened when the Negro and white masses of the South threatened to unite and build a great society. So people need to understand why it is that we're so divided in the first place, and the way that that distracts our society from being what we all hope that it could be, what the actual promises in the Declaration of Independence. These racial divisions on purpose divide us and make it so that we can't have things that other comparable nations have.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Our program is an interactive show. We encourage you to be part of our conversation as we talk about the complexities of race, Aunt Jemima and the complexities of race, a conversation about stereotypes and race relations in Central Kentucky, sponsored by Kentucky Humanities. That's happening on the Thursday evening, September 21st, but of course our program repeats on a Sunday evening, and you can also listen to it as a podcast. So you may be listening way after this session has occurred, but if you're listening on Thursday morning, we encourage you to call in and be part of our conversation, 800-621-8890. Send us an email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com, or send a tweet at wekuest. That phone number again, 800-621-8890. And of course, even after the program, we encourage you to carry on the conversation on the WEKU website at weku.fm or on the Facebook page. I want to turn to Ricardo Nazario Colon and Colon, pardon me, and talk about, when we talk about racism and minority racial stereotypes, where do persons of Hispanic origin and persons of other national origin fit into this picture? I mean, it's always, you know, the issue has, to a great extent, focused on white versus black in this country, and Hispanics are about to become the majority in this country. Is that not true?
Well, not necessarily the majority as in
Or the majority minority. The primary minority in our nation.
Right. And you know, the conversation begins in application forms. So think about if you identify as Hispanic in this country, your racial category, and we all have different racial categories, is an optional thing. So once you're Hispanic, you get counted as Hispanic. And there's now a movement to say, not only am I Hispanic, but I'm also Black, or I'm multiracial, or I am white. Or in the case of people from Guatemala and Honduras, you know, I'm either of African descent, the Garifuna people, or I am Mayan. 80%+ of Guatemalans are indigenous, and they speak Mayan. So sometimes we encounter people here in Kentucky who don't speak Spanish, and we assume because they're Hispanic that they speak Spanish. For the Latino Hispanic population, you know, because we are the spectrum of people, we get pulled to many different sides. And the reality is that we're also a community that's struggling to be heard, to share our individual experiences, which are very different, right? So Mexican Americans, who make up the majority of Latino Hispanics in this country, over 60%, have a very different narrative. They have a claim to this nation. Half, a good chunk, 48% of this nation out west was occupied by people of Spanish descent. And we know it in Texas, Arizona, Colorado. All of those are Spanish names. So there's a huge legacy there. Folks in the east, like Puerto Ricans, Cubans, have a different narrative. We have an identity that's forged around our islands, right? And within our own community, we're still struggling to find our identity. In the conversation nowadays, we're being pitted against African Americans. We're being pitted against Native Americans. In other words, the narrative that we want to move, we want to confuse you by race or nationality or ethnic continues. That heritage of moving the pieces for people and not letting them focus on what's needed, which is the services, good education. That is important in the Hispanic community as well, and that is part of our conversation.
We're going to take another short break and come back to our conversation on stereotypes and race relations in Central Kentucky on this week's Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. The phone line is open, 800-621-8890. We do have a caller on the line, Latoya from Lexington. If you'll hold on there, we'll get you on the air in just a few moments after we take a short break. You can send us an email, WEKUEasternStandard@gmail.com, or send a tweet at WEKUEST. Again, our phone number, 800-621-8890.
Well, your ideas, they takes off, and you get to be successful rich, like me. You do well in this world, you gots to share. God made you rich for a reason.
Aunt Jemima, portrayed by actress Deborah Falk. Actually, Aunt Jemima, portrayed by Nancy Green, was her name. Kentuckian, again, she was from what part of Kentucky again, Bill Goodman?
Born and raised in Montgomery County, Kentucky.
And something that, is that widely known among Kentuckians?
No.
I think I first learned it in the last couple of weeks is when you announced this workshop.
I like to take that quiz to audiences that I speak to about our Chautauqua actors. There is a rich heritage to each and every one of them. One of our new Chautauqua actors is William Wells Brown. When I say that to audiences, they say, oh, yeah, the school's named after him in Lexington, the grade school. William Wells Brown was the first African-American novelist in the world. Hmm. And he was from also Montgomery County, Kentucky.
And again, the actress Deborah Falk portraying Nancy Green, portraying Aunt Jemima, will be part of the workshop, Aunt Jemima and the Complexities of Race, that is occurring on Thursday evening, September 21st. This is Eastern Standard, 800-621-8890, our phone number. And hopefully still on the line, we have Latoya from Lexington, who decided to call in and be part of our conversation. Latoya, are you still there?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you. Thank you for calling. Go right ahead.
Yes, I have a comment for the lady that's on the panel. I'm not sure what her name is.
That is Dr. Kelly Madison.
Okay, Dr. Kelly Madison, I just want to let you know that I greatly appreciate you being on the show because you are bringing forth a lot of information and a lot of history that a lot of people don't know about today. And I think that's very important for everyone to know if we want to get past the race issue that we have going on. As far as the terms Black and African American being created to separate people of color, I feel like those terms need to be thrown out. And all of us need to be labeled as Americans. And that way we can stop having everyone being segregated in that way by color.
Yes. Thank you, LaToya. I think for me, what I'm talking about is not necessarily the term African American, but the terms Black, white, red, yellow races, because we're literally not races. This is something that scientists have been trying to say us throughout the entire 20th century, and still to this day, people have not gotten the memo on that because it's so deeply ingrained. I definitely agree with you that we are all Americans, and we need to start seeing ourselves as all Americans and seeing us as united in terms of wanting our society to be a place that's just, a place where we have access to resources that we need. So in that sense, I absolutely agree. I don't have a problem with the term African American. I use, instead of the term white, I use European American, Asian Americans, and just Americans in general, I think, when we get to the mentality that can understand that.
Black and African American are slave names, along with colored and Negro. They're not actually nationalities. So I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. If you do your DNA, you might find out where exactly in Africa your people come from. That's exactly what I did, and it was very interesting to learn. But for most people in the United States who are of African descent, we don't know exactly what countries we came from, because once you get into the slave records, there's nothing there but your name, whether you're a mulatto sometimes, and your age. So, yeah.
Also, another thing I wanted to bring up was, I don't know how true it is, but I've found out recently that there was only a small percentage of Africans that came over here on slave ships, and the majority of the people were already here, and they were shipped out across the sea to Europe and to Africa and Arab nations for slavery. I don't know how much you know about that.
I don't know a lot about the statistics on that. I know that at a certain point, slavery, the actual importation of slaves was stopped, and there were already, I'm not sure what the number would be, but in the millions of slaves, people being enslaved in the United States, that helped to continue that on just through having offspring.
All right.
John? Of the people came over here on slave ships, or would you say that most of us were already here? But of course, I mean, everyone originated out of Africa, so we're all probably going to have some type or a small percentage of, you know, African blood in this, but I'm inclined to believe that most of us were already here.
I can speak to that.
All right. Yeah.
So the historical record, whether you believe it was 100 million Africans or 10 million Africans that were enslaved and brought across the sea, there were people already inhabiting this country, and those are the First Nations of the new continent. We know them, refer to them as Indian, misnomer, or Native American, or First Peoples. Only 4% of the enslavement trade came to the United States. The majority of it went to Latin America and Central America. There were individuals, particularly Cherokee folks and some African Americans or enslaved people of African descent from the Carolinas, who were sent out of the United States, mostly to the Caribbean, to work in sugar farms and things of that nature. But in terms of the population that was here, we already know that it was the people who identify as First Nations.
All right. Latoya, thank you so much for your call. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Phone lines open for the next 13 minutes or so, 800-621-8890, if you'd like to be part of our conversation, talking about stereotypes and race relations in Central Kentucky in the context of Aunt Jemima and the complexities of race, a workshop or a session being sponsored by the Kentucky Humanities Council. Our guests are Dr. Kelly Madison, professor of cultural politics and media studies at California State University, Ricardo Nazario Colon, chief diversity officer for Western Carolina University. We have with us former family court judge John Schrader, and we have Bill Goodman, executive director of the Kentucky Humanities Council, on the air with us this morning. 800-621-8890. Kelly Madison, let me toss this out to you as a result of Latoya's question. What are we missing in Black history? I know every year we observe Black History Month in February, and I'm wondering, do you feel that people are really learning what they need to be learning, and who's learning it? I mean, and who is Black History Month geared to? I mean, is this something I feel like, to a great extent, a lot of the folks in the Black community have made an effort to learn about history because during Black History Month, but I feel like many of us seem to maybe miss the boat or really not benefit from the sharing of this history.
Well, not to belabor the point, but if I had it my way, actually, it wouldn't be called Black History Month. Black History Month would be the history of how African people were racialized and what blackness came to mean and what the consequences of that were economically, politically, socially, and morally in this country. I like American History Month. Me and Latoya might have an argument about the term African American history. But things that aren't taught, there's a great new book called White Rage. I can't recall the woman's name, but it's called White Rage. And what I'm learning from that book, I mean, there's always so much more to learn, but the ways in which African Americans after the end of Reconstruction, after the Civil War, after the end of Reconstruction, were re-enslaved through all kinds of laws, through the Black Codes, through criminalizing Black people for not having jobs if they didn't have a job, and for all of the other things that they faced as newly freed people, and then basically reinstating slavery, and then the massive amount of violence. I think that's one thing people don't know perhaps enough about. I had to put the book down. It was so disturbing, the level of violence that African American people have faced. And I think the important thing is to think about this in human terms. What is it that was going on with European American people that made it so that the idea of African people being free was something that was so terrible that they would commit these horrendous and heinous acts against African people? That's a human question. And part of it is what I was saying that Martin Luther King said, which is to have told people who are of European descent in this country, who are not of the wealthy classes, you may not have anything else, but one thing you can count on is that you are better than this other group of people. You can take their stuff. You can lynch them and take their farms. You can kill the Native American people and take their land. In a way, it was normalizing the types of values and political relations that the capitalist class was institutionalizing, which is about taking things by force.
And the book you're referring to, White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide, by Carol Anderson. Thank you, Bill Goodman, for looking that up.
And part of that the violence that was imposed upon Black people, African Americans in this country, came from a narrative that we've been hearing about, you're not contributing to this nation. That's why we can take your things. And there's a historical figure, Arturo Alfonso Schomburg, and many people might recognize the last name Schomburg because the Schomburg Library in New York City is named after him, and his records are what built that library. But Arthur Schomburg was told when he was in grade school in Puerto Rico that Black people had never accomplished anything in the world. So he made it his life mission to collect, and he became a bibliophile, and he collected everything about the contributions of black people from around the world. And we have an excellent collection, historical record, that shows that throughout the history of humanity, people of African descent have contributed a lot, not only to this country, but to the entire world. And that is part of the narrative that, of the white supremacist narrative, that people of color, that people of African descent have not contributed anything of meaning, which is an outright lie.
I mean, I'm thinking of the National Museum of African American History and Culture, now in D.C., part of the Smithsonian institutions, and I actually had the great pleasure to actually check out that museum, and I know that the waiting list is amazing. I think about thousands of people trying to get into it. I was recently in Washington for a conference, and we managed to check that out. I'm wondering your perception, Ricardo and Kelly Madison, about what good this new museum is going to accomplish and how it's going to move us forward in terms of our understanding of the complexities of race.
Well, it's important to know that people have contributed, you know, to the nation. But also when we talk about correcting their historical record, when we talk about putting out the honest truth out there, we begin to build social capital. We begin to develop not monetary but intellectual wealth for our new generation. And I think that is part of the narrative that we're not talking about when we're talking about individuals in the penal system, individuals in the educational system, and their performances or lack thereof. It is that when people are born in this nation today, there are empty vessels, and we need to make sure that there is a generational wealth and intellectual wealth that's being handed down. If it isn't there, you're not going to be able to perform. So it is important that we rediscover our history, that we present it in a positive way and in an accurate way.
And Bill Goodman.
John, I just wanted to add that because Dr. Madison referred to it earlier in the conversation, this we're recording, we're live on Thursday. This is repeated on Sunday night. But I wanted to say that following our discussion at the Lyric on Thursday evening, we're going to be, as Dr. Madison referred to earlier, at Frederick Douglass High School for the same conversation. As Ricardo just pointed out, the vessels that need to be filled with facts and accurate information are these young people. And we are working with Principal Lester Diaz at the new Frederick Douglass High School to bring in representatives of all of students from Fayette County High Schools to hear and participate in this same conversation. And we think that's, again, a mission that we have and certainly important hopefully that is going to fulfill some of the areas that Ricardo spoke to.
Let me very quickly go to Robin in Lexington, who is on the line. Robin, thank you for calling, being part of this week's Eastern Standard. Go right ahead with your question or your comment.
Good morning, John. I really appreciate this discussion, and I've learned a lot from your show this morning. I'm a critical care nurse in Lexington, Kentucky, and I can see the racial inequalities in my community and even in my workplace and the disproportionate amount of gunshot victims, based on race. And I've learned a lot from what I've heard. My question is, what can we do based on this information? I just need some guidance on what we can do to help address some of these racial inequalities now that we've learned some of the origins of them, and I just like to know what we can do to help.
All right, let me toss that to our guest, Judge John Schrader, former family court judge in Lexington and Fayette County.
Well, that may be up my alley. I'm a nuts and bolts guy. I'm in the world of historians and academic people here on this panel. But I would refer us to a speech that President Obama made in January of 2014. He talks about the way we need to talk to our young people and how we need to educate them on what's right and how to treat each other. And
He has said in that speech, I want every young man in America to feel some strong peer pressure in terms of how they're supposed to behave and treat women. Those of us who are fathers have an obligation to transmit that information. We can do more to make sure that every man out there in junior high, high school, and college understands what's expected of them, what it means to be a man, and to intervene if they see someone else acting inappropriately. And so we have to teach respect to our young people. That's the reason that we're facing these problems. There's no respect for authority. There's no respect for the parents, for the teachers, for the police, for the judge, and even for the president. He is our president. He was elected according to our laws. And so we need to teach our young people to have respect. And he further said in that speech, he was telling young men about how to avoid sexual abuse. And he said what they need to hear, and that is, it's not going to happen overnight. You have to set goals, and you're going to have to work for your goals. Nothing will be given to you. You're going to have to work. We have to educate our young people about work ethic.
Some good points for us to conclude our conversation. Very quickly, Bill Goodman, where else can folks go beside this workshop, this session happening on Thursday evening, for more information about these issues and resources from Kentucky Humanities?
The community conversation will be held. We'll do our best to do as much as we can to continue to promote this kind of conversation throughout the state of Kentucky.
Will there be a record of it? Will there be a video or materials online?
We will do our best to have as much information on our website as possible.
Bill Goodman of the Kentucky Humanities Council, thank you for being with us. Judge John Schrader, thank you. And Ricardo Nazario Colon, and also Dr. Kelly Madison, thanks for being part of this week's Eastern Standard. Our producers, our associate producers are Emily Hutchison, we have Zach Redding, and Brian Burkhardt. I'm John Hingsbergen. Be sure to check out our podcast online at weku.fm. It'll be there this afternoon.
You can hear a rebroadcast of today's Eastern Standard coming up Sunday evening at 6 on 88.9 WEKU and have downloadable audio later today and through the weekend at our website, weku.fm.
On the next Fresh Air.
I remember my knees shaking, and I was saying, holy smokes, I'm going into war. This is war.
We talk with Ken Burns and Lynn Novick about their new PBS documentary series, The Vietnam War, which is told from multiple perspectives, including the North Vietnamese. Join us.
Today's Fresh Air, from 3 until 4, right before All Things Considered, on 88.9 WEKU Richmond Lexington, 90.9 WEKH Hazard, 88.5 WEKF Corbin, and 90.1 WEKP Pineville. We're also at 95.1 FM in Pikeville and online at weku.fm. Interact with us, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, a community service of Eastern Kentucky University.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Coming up, at a school in Mexico City where more than 20 people were killed in the earthquake, rescuers are trying to free one little girl from the rubble.
She certainly is the hope, and she really is emblematic of the overall hope of the rescue operations at that school, which is really the epicenter of this tragedy.
Also, we check in with a young reporter in Puerto Rico, riding out his first hurricane. Power is out, the island is ravaged.
I've been trying to contact my grandmother, and I haven't heard, you know, since the hurricane. I'm trying to keep calm.
And